Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robin Hood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts. Underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
Well, thank you, Marshall. And even though Off Script is about theater topics, today we're going to go off script, as we have done in the past. And we're going to have a show today about a book, especially we do have interview shows about books that have some political or cultural import. And this one today does from a very, very local angle. Today we have the author about an incident that happened right here in the northwest corner of Connecticut in the 1880s. That said as much about its time as some might be reminded of events that are nationally occurring these days. The book is called The Lakeville Crucifix, and it's a tale of anti-Irish and anti-Roman Catholicism in Salisbury, small town northwest Connecticut, where the Protestant Yankee held real power. The author is Salisbury resident Jeff Brown, who is an expert in local history and genealogy, and whose enterprise Between the Lakes Group republishes local history, principally about New England and the Northeast. Welcome, Jeff.
Dan, I'm glad to be here.
Well, congratulations on the book. I finished it last night, and it's easy to read, number one. It's not very long. It's 300 pages, large-ish print, so I don't want to intimidate anyone because it's a history book. It's really entertaining, mostly because it's really chock full of all kinds of local history, but mostly it's provocative, too, because it explains so much about the macro political and cultural factors of the 19th century that were at play both in the United States and abroad. And it really gets to how all of that history remains in some ways, like it or not, part of our national history today. But before we get into all that, before we get into all the whys about the behind your story, the title, The Lakeville Crucifix, please explain to us simply what happened and when.
In 1882, Father Lynch, the founder or the first rector of St. Mary's Church in Lakeville, decided to erect a crucifix in the front yard of St. Mary's. If you know the terrain, it's a triangular-shaped piece of ground facing downtown Lakeville.
Rather dangerous intersection at this point in time.
This point it is. That point it probably was not, but it certainly was visible, considering we had a lot less tree growth at that point.
The intersection of Route 41 and Wellsville Road.
Exactly. Right, and 12 feet high with a near life-size figure of Jesus on it. Mm-hmm. And this simmered over the winter, and the following summer, a great deal of ill feeling developed in the Protestant majority in town about this crucifix, and a movement developed to have it taken down because it was offensive to the local Protestant majority. They got together a meeting and formulated a petition requesting that the priest take down his crucifix. And three local luminaries presented it to him. They were politely received. The crucifix did not come down. And everyone was surprised. The next step was for another group of luminaries from the same group to petition William H. Barnum, who was the CEO of Barnum Richardson Company in Lime Rock and the employer of many or most, perhaps, of Father Lynch's congregants, to exercise his influence on Father Lynch to have the crucifix taken down. Now, that influence may have been complicated somewhat by the fact that Barnum, who was religiously an Episcopalian, had just donated $8,000 to Father Lynch to build a convent and school associated with the church. At any rate, Senator Barnum was polite, and once again, nothing happened. At this point, the congregation decided to boycott the Lakeville Merchants.
These are mostly Irish.
Yes.
Mostly Irish Catholic immigrants.
Absolutely, Dan.
Boycotting Protestant merchants.
Absolutely. Okay. Totally right. And that raised everyone's temperature a good bit.
Mm-hmm.
It proceeded. The boycott was not successful in changing things. The good father was planning to have a big deal, a reception, bringing Catholic dignitaries and parishioners from all over the state for a dedication of the convent that had just been built. The Protestant majority largely controlled such things as the Town Grove, then privately owned, a steamboat on Lakeville Lake, which I still find preposterous, and use of and booking excursion trains on the Central New England Railroad and on the Housatonic. Father Lynch got a good bit of blowback on all that and never did get the Town Grove or the steamboat. But via some machinations did end up with his trains. I suspect that Senator Barnum may have had a bit to do with those trains running, since at the time he was also CEO of the Housatonic Railroad.
So you've got this local incident. You've got luminaries from industry, Barnum mm-hmm. Richardson being the major employer in town of the iron business. You've got the religious leadership of New England getting involved to mm-hmm. back up Lynch. And you also got national press attention. How did that come about? Because that's a big factor in how you tell this story.
You would not think that this would be front page news in the New York Times, but it was. It was front page news repeatedly in the New York Times.
And the Hartford Courant.
Oh, of course, the Hartford Courant to quite an extent.
And just by way of background, we did not have a town newspaper like the Lakeville Journal. There was just one newspaper that covered all of Western Massachusetts. Am I right?
And that's right. I think at this point in time it was located in Canaan, however. So it was more local than say oh, the Waterbury Republican would have been.
Well, at the time, Lakeville was, speaking of the steamship, and it was a fashionable destination for weekenders, given the railroads to come up here.
Yes.
But how did the New York Times and the Hartford Courant pick up this story? I mean, why would the New York Times care about a crucifix on a lousy piece of dirt in Lakeville, Connecticut?
Dan, you are leading me into the meat of this story, and I thank you very much for that skillful intro. As it turned out, this may, and I can't prove that it was, have been a proxy for a fairly major political dust-up between them nationally, between the Democrats, since Barnum was also the chairman of the National Democratic Committee at that point, and Holly, who was a prominent Governor Alexander Holly, was a prominent Republican. The Hartford Courant was a Republican paper. The New York Times was Republican at that point. Let me pull back and say that. That's a bit of a surprise for many. The Hartford Courant was also Republican.
Now, when you say Republican, you mean the newly formed party of Abraham Lincoln?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
But just if you could give us a little more background, because you get into this in amazing detail in your book. The people that associated themselves with the newly formed Republican Party of Abraham Lincoln before that were affiliated with the Know-Nothing Party.
Well, many of them were.
Uh-huh.
Many of them indeed were. As a matter of fact, I mentioned Governor Holly. That man performed a feat of political legerdemain that, in retrospect, I've never heard or seen or heard of and have trouble imagining. In 1855, he was lieutenant governor of Connecticut on for the Whig Party. The following year, he didn't run for office, but he was the state chairman for the Know-Nothing Party. The following year, that's year one, he's a Whig. Year two, he's a Know-Nothing. Year three, he's governor on a fusion ticket incorporating the Know-Nothings and the anti-slavery Republicans. Mm-hmm. And I honestly, the mind still boggles that someone was that politically adept as to be able to have all three of those essentially balls in the row in the air at the same time.
I want to get to the Democratic side of this little tussle, but let me remind everybody, you're listening to Off Script. Today I'm talking with Jeff Brown. He is a historian of New England matters and a genealogist, and he's just published a book called Lakeville Crucifix, A Religious War in the 19th Century Connecticut. So you've got Holly, who was a native of Salisbury, right? Who was a governor of Connecticut at the time. And then you've got this guy, Barnum, who was the major industrialist in the area, who also was a real politician because he was the chairman of the National Democratic Committee.
Yes.
So how did these two power centers play off, and what ramifications did that have on the local Protestant merchant and the local Irish maid?
Well, The local Protestant merchant was almost by definition at that point a Republican. The largely Irish, almost entirely Irish Catholic congregation of St. Mary's were pretty uniformly Democrats, and those were and of course we also had a very important fact that of the Irish immigration. When people talk about immigration today, we're really talking about pretty small potatoes when you compare it with the influx of very poor, frequently illiterate Irish during the potato famine. Many of whom didn't speak English, even English with a brogue. They spoke Irish, which was sort of a dialect of Gaelic, and often because of privation in Ireland, came ill with nothing but the clothes they had on, such as they were, and occasionally with diseases and so forth. They were not an attractive. They were a desperate group, I can
go back and talk Irish history for a thousand years.
The question is because what I picked up from your book was that the Irish that came in the 1880s, as you've just described, uneducated, largely, illiterate. Were not the same kind of Irish or the same kind of Catholic that came earlier. And I want you to talk a little bit about – because you talk about the different kind of religion that was practiced in the early part of the country by the Catholics and then the devotional kind of Catholicism that was practiced by this illiterate group of Irish that come later. And what it suggests to me – and talk about this – besides being religious distinctions between Protestant and Catholics, the new kind of Irish immigrant was sort of a class below the old-fashioned Catholics that had been here for a while.
That's absolutely true, Dan. The class thing certainly enters into it a great deal. But the transformation in the Catholic Church, globally, in this period was profound. Early settlers, early Catholic settlers in America tended to come to Maryland, tended to be reasonably high class English, and people who had learned to basically be true to both their faith and their king at the same time, which was a juggling act in itself. And they indeed had Protestant servants in general. Mm-hmm. The Catholicism that developed in America was being influenced by generally liberal trends nationally and a profound shortage of clergy. And it's probably important to realize that of the first five Catholic dioceses in America were Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, Boston, and Bardstown, Kentucky, which is where the Kentucky or the Maryland Catholics had emigrated.
It's also the bourbon capital of the world.
It certainly
yes,
is.
I've been there many, many years ago.
It certainly is. But you put that together, and you had a Catholic population that was not that distinguishable in America generally from the various branches of Protestant churches, and there was a fair amount of cross intermarriage and a fair amount of visiting each other's churches, going to a Catholic church if there wasn't a Protestant church around, or vice versa. And then came Giuseppe Garibaldi attacking Rome, basically locking up Pope Pius IX and taking this liberal pope, as he started out, and producing in a matter of a rather few years an arch-conservative who gave rise to the doctrine of papal infallibility, the syllabus of errors, and Vatican I, which was a conservative movement in the Catholic Church in order of magnitude, was about three times as big a hit as Vatican II was 100 or so years later. I've lost my.
So are you suggesting that just as putting a cross on a piece of dirt in Lakeville would be a classless, tasteless representation of this kind of newfound conservative devotional Catholicism,
yes,
in contrast to the patriarchal, or the patrician rather,
yes,
kind of Catholicism in the 19th century, with this Vatican I, that Protestants reacted to the notion of papal infallibility even at a local level like Lakeville, that the Catholics were just getting too much power. That the Pope had too much power.
Yes, yes, very much so. That the Pope had too much power, that the decisions of the individual parishioner in the pew in Lakeville was the decision of the Pope in Rome.
Uh-huh.
And that it proceeded straight down. It was a direct line through the prelates, through the priest, to the parishioner, who did what the Pope said.
So these uneducated, dirty Irish were agents of the Pope.
That was the local perception.
Corrupting the nice Yankee Protestant society that had existed peacefully, because there were Catholics in this area before.
There were.
The Irish had come earlier,
mm-hmm,
but there was peaceful coexistence.
Pretty much.
Okay.
It seems like there was.
Let's talk about the economics of the area, because many people who are new to the area anyway don't understand, and you can fill this in, that this area was really the economic capital of many of the colonies because of the munitions that were developed during the Revolutionary War. But the iron business was big.
Yes.
How did that inform the power structure in Lakeville at the time?
Well, let it be said that only a few years before the story took place, Lakeville was not Lakeville. It was called Furnace Village because of a large blast furnace located pretty much where the town Grove is. Well, a little closer to the gas station, but right in that general area. And if you can imagine living around a blast furnace, that's what Lakeville was. There was another blast furnace up on Mount Moriah. Lime Rock had two of them. There were a bunch in East Canaan. There were a couple in Sharon. There was one in Millerton and a few in Dover Plains. There was a good-sized iron industry right in this area. It had escaped British attention or British destruction during the American Revolution because it was simply too hard to get here. You couldn't bring a column of troops up here and
take it, demolish it, and as a result, continue to crank out cannons for the duration of the Revolution. With the development of railroads, there was even more demand for iron in the form of railroad car wheels, and that's largely what Barnum made. And he made them not just in Lime Rock with iron smelted in East Canaan and Millerton and Cornwall Bridge and a few other places, but also he made them in Chicago and West Virginia.
And this is the point, and this is how the iron industry had evolved in Salisbury by the time of your story.
Yes. Okay. I mentioned Governor Holly, his family, his grandfather, was a earlier entrepreneur in the iron business. But the iron business largely, as tends to happen in startup industries, consolidated strongly, and Barnum ended up heading the firm that encompassed the assets of many of the former smaller iron entrepreneurs.
And the locus of his business is now in the Lime Rock at the bottom of Samuel Kill Road, and then the Lime Rock area of Lakeville. Now, most of his workers, most of his employees, the guys that did the grunt work, were Irish.
Yes, they were, and particularly the miners at Ore Hill. Right. And Ore Hill, right on Route 44 between Lakeville and Millerton, now a lake, used huge numbers of Irish, almost entirely, miners to go in and pick and shovel the stuff up, load it into wagons, drive oxen pulling the wagons to the places where the blast furnaces were to smelt it.
Question about the Irish coming up, but first I want to remind everyone the program is Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer. My guest today is Jeffrey Brown, who's a genealogist and historian and has written a fascinating new book called Lakeville Crucifix, A Religious War in 19th Century Connecticut, about an anti-Irish, anti-Catholic incident right here in Lakeville in 1882. Okay, so Barnum is the chairman of the National Democratic Party. He owns the biggest business in town. He's got Irish workers for him. He's faced with a local Holly, who's Protestant, Congregationalist, governor of Connecticut. And the governor of Connecticut knows in the back of his head that there's also a thing going on in New York called Tammany Hall that's populated by a bunch of corrupt Irish too.
Talk
about how that factors in.
Well, that's if you had to identify one thing that probably leaned on Barnum's decisions more than anything else, it was the extent to which the Democratic Party at that point was dependent on urban Irish, if you wish, in the case of Tammany Hall, certainly, machine politics. And it was not it would certainly have been not to Barnum's advantage and likely to the Democratic Party's advantage for him to be all that Protestant, if you know what I mean.
Exactly. Right. So we've got this crucifix on this patch of dirt. We've got the background politics of the newly formed Irish immigrant, urban-based Democratic Party, Irish workers, Protestant Republicans holding the power in town. How does the Catholic bishop in Hartford figure into all this?
Well, for some reason, the Protestants seem to have felt that if they simply appealed to the bishop, the bishop would tell this arrogant priest to take his crucifix away. if you look a little bit into his past, you'll find that was improbable at best. Mm-hmm. He was one of the first bishops created by Pope Leo XIII, who immediately followed Pius IX, who of course was the mover and shaker in terms of Vatican I.
Who wanted to enforce this new devotional conservative Catholicism.
Absolutely. And the devotionalism, you know, it had good reason. It had good uses itself. If you had a Latin a mass being said in Latin, you had people who couldn't read English or Latin or probably anything else in the pews, and
you needed somehow to get a religious message across to them and give them something to think about and do.
And mystify them.
Well, of course.
Yes.
And what better? I mean, you could have sodalities and you could have you could have various devotional books, but if they couldn't read them, what good were they? You needed things.
We've got one more. We've got time for one more topic, and we can, I think, relate this to today. One of the biggest factors that came into play, besides the economics locally in the iron business, besides this Protestant Catholic divisionism division, was the whole issue of nativism. We hear about it in today's news. You talk about it in your book. Briefly, how did it play out?
Wow.
In less than 2 minutes,
please. In less than 2 minutes, Dan. Please. That's a great trick. Nativism was not a bunch of, if you wish, ignorant rabble running around with torches for the most part. There was a fairly strong New England tradition of nativistic viewpoints, largely within the Congregational Church. Names that might or might not mean much to today's reader were significant, had significant ties with nativism and made fiery speeches. And Abraham Lincoln contrasted the nativists, who despised the Irish, with their colleagues, and not infrequently the same people, who wished to free the slaves.
Mm-hmm.
He saw the inherent conflict in that little bit of ideological legerdemain.
Right.
And I think, although I'm sure he was glad to have their votes.
Right. One final question I'm going to ask, but I'm not going to ask you to answer, is what happened to the crucifix? Because I think people should buy the book and read the book and find out how this little chapter concludes, except I can fairly say, I think, that the residual effects of this are still kicking around in different form.
I think you could say that.
Yeah.
While I think all the local religious groups get along quite well now.
Mm-hmm. Part of our history.
It is certainly part of our history.
Okay. The book, Lakeville Crucifix, A Religious War in the 19th Century Connecticut by Jeff Brown, is available at Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, which I should add is underwritten this program, and more immediately for delivery by mail through Amazon.com. So you can order it through there, or you can come visit Johnny Cake Books. And I thank Jeff Brown for visiting us today, and thank you for your book, The Lakeville Crucifix. Thanks for joining us, too. And until the next time you join in, as a dear departed friend of mine used to say, be well.
Underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.